Hi, I'm Karen Elliott, and you're listening to the District B-Sides podcast, where you'll hear in-depth conversations with council, staff, and community members to take you behind the decisions that are being made on topics that matter to Squamish. Now let's tune in and join the conversation.
Welcome, everyone, to a new episode of District B-Sides, the District of Squamish's podcast, to talk about some of the challenges and opportunities that our community is facing. So I'm here today with Jenna Stoner, one of our counselors, and also Ian Pigetts, who's our manager of climate change and sustainability. And we've just wrapped up a mayor's drop-in conversation on climate change. And so we thought we would take a few minutes to share what we learned, some questions that are still on our minds about acting on climate change. And happy to receive your feedback after you've listened to our podcast. So thanks very much. So it was a really interesting conversation. There wasn't a huge group of people there. We actually had a few district staff members there and three community members. But it was a far-ranging conversation, which I really enjoyed and appreciated. I think one of the big things that sort of kicked off this conversation was the idea that climate change is, people are really feeling that sense of urgency. And I think you said this, Ian, it's not a problem of the future anymore. People can start to make the connections now to the fact that climate change is real. We can see it in wildfire. We can see it in major weather events. There's more science that is coming out now, showing these connections to changes that are happening all around us right now. But one of the things that I'm always concerned about in terms of the speed of reacting to and making changes around climate is that we don't leave people behind, and this idea of equity. So what did you hear in the conversation around the climate change file and equity in our conversation that we just had?
That's to me, it was certainly like a really prevalent point in our conversation. And I feel like it came up over and over, which is, it's really important to be mindful of that. You know, climate change is, it's fundamentally inequitable in so many ways, down to the point, like not just from an individual in a community, the more vulnerable people in a community are going to be more effective, but the more vulnerable communities are going to be more affected as well globally. So yeah, I think that I was really happy to hear that. And just as us going forward, I think as a municipality, we have to be really thoughtful about that. And we can't just kind of ask people to spend our way out of this. Electric vehicles are great. They're a huge part of the solution. Home energy retrofits are great. They're a huge part of the solution, but on their own, they're not sufficient. And we have to understand that a lot of people can't do those things. So, yeah. So I think, you know, just equity has to be at the forefront of our thinking about this.
Yeah. And Jenna, you know, you're an elected representative like myself. One of our community members brought up the idea of, you know, Vancouver looking at mobility-based pricing and how that can seem like a really good idea. If you're traveling a long distance in a car, you should pay for that. But pointed out that oftentimes it's workers who've been priced out of the Vancouver market. So the wealthy are living in Vancouver. People that have been priced out have to move further out and then commute to their jobs. And so is it actually a progressive policy or a regressive policy? And I think those are things that we grapple with. What's on your mind when you think about climate and equity?
I think with all the actions that we are looking to take, both at the district, the municipal level, and then where we advocate to higher levels of government, for policy change, it's definitely something that we always have at the forefront of our mind is how equitable is that policy going to be? And I think that example of mobility pricing is a really good one where it has, from a scientific and theoretical perspective, it makes a lot of sense as it can have significant impact from a climate perspective. But if you don't overlap that equity lens, you just end up really harming, doing more harm than good in the long run. And so I think it is, for me, it is it's a lens that I put on top of all of the discussions that we have around climate. They aren't one, they aren't two separate pieces. They're one and the same. And I think that has to go for everybody who is participating and actively engaged in this conversation, that we can't separate those two. And if we do, then we won't be able to create the future that we are actually looking to create, which is more equitable and climate friendly. We end up with a future that is more divisive in the long term.
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing that actually we didn't touch on in Mayor's drop-in, although we did talk about youth, was in my mind, the idea of generational equity. And one of the reasons that I got involved in politics is because I knew that one day my daughters would look up at me and say, "What did you do? Like, you knew this was happening, and did you do anything?" And then back in 2014, I was like, I don't really have a good answer for that question when it comes. And so this idea of what is our responsibility as adults to take action now, because we can't just pass on the damage to the next generation and make it their problem. That's already happened for far too long. If you look at, so when how long have we been talking about climate change scientifically, Ian? It's decades.
Yeah, well, we proved the greenhouse effect in 1860, which was
right.
The year before Darwin. So yeah, it's been we've known this for a while.
Yeah. So that idea of generational equity, that is our responsibility. We need to act today and with a sense of urgency. The time is now. And I think the scientific reports and the consensus around that make it clear that really by 2030, we have to act. And so we have 9 years left. And so I know that that fuels my fire, and definitely the idea that we can't leave people behind. We, as you say, and we can't buy our way out of this problem for everyone. So go ahead, Jenna.
That was, I think, a big part of the conversation too, in terms of we know that there is this time crunch. 2030 is only 9 years away, but that creates this tension around how fast, how quickly should we be taking these actions, and also giving our community time to come along with us in those changes that need to happen. And that was a piece of the conversation from the mayor's drop-in that I pulled out and really appreciated some reflection on, is exactly that. Like, that we have 9 years. That is not very much time. I feel like we should have been doing this 10 years ago already. And so that's just a piece that I wanted to highlight from our conversation as well.
Well, and it touches on how we communicate this, right? And so there was definitely a sense of that the district could be doing a better job creating the link, not just around climate mitigation or climate adaptation, but how it leads us to a better community, a more healthy community, a more sustainable community, and really better painting that vision of it's not just climate mitigation for mitigation's sake or for climate's sake, but it actually could provide real benefits to the residents of the community. And so, I mean, Ian, your team is at the forefront of sort of, you've launched our new webpage around climate action. You know, how do you think about how we need to communicate with people in Squamish around climate? Yours on mute.
Oh, I just said something so smart too, but I forgot it. No. we definitely did have that in mind with the website. Definitely something we can work more toward. You'll notice in our climate action checklist, we have a list of icons that show the co-benefits of all of these different actions. So that was something we were working toward. One thing I'll throw in that just for interest sake is you can go to a level where you can, like, if you kind of tuck climate away too deeply, I think that is also problematic though. You don't want to just have better living and then, by the way, you're dealing with climate change. I do think we need to overtly note and name the challenge and that motivation. So I think there needs to be a balance of climate change being part of this positive vision for a community, but also being clear that these are actions that we are taking to address this. If it's just a side benefit, sometimes for other reasons, it can get taken away for, so it's a careful balance.
I think, you know, we, related to this idea of communication is actually the idea that too much focus has been put on individual action versus systemic action. And so, you know, certainly before I was elected, we tried not to own a car. We tried to, you know, change our diet. I did win the zero waste challenge for council. So thinking about, you know, what we buy and then how we dispose of it. But where's the line for you, Jenna, between individual action versus the systemic action, the really big policy changes that the government needs to make to, you know, by saying that we're single-use items all have to be made from a compostable material, or we are now going to change the BC building code to limit fossil fuel infrastructure in new buildings. Like, those are big levers, senior levels of government, that big kind of systemic change that can happen, versus getting people engaged by giving them agency and telling them what they can do to help. Where does that land for you?
To me, both matter, and almost equally, but in different ways. So when we think about climate change and the greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets and look at it at a global level, I hate to say this, but your individual actions actually really don't matter. They're a drop in the bucket in terms of if I was able to produce zero GHG emissions as an individual relative to our global GHG emissions, that's great, but it's actually not going to change the trajectory that we're on as a whole globe. That's where that systemic change comes in and is so critical. But where the individual action really does matter is in order to socialize and normalize efforts towards that will enable that systemic change to happen. So building that community support in order to build more bike lanes and put more money towards transport or transit and active transportation. And so the individual action matters to a greater degree as well, because that is what normalizes that change in societal behavior and provides the community and political support to make that systemic change. And so it's easy to feel like as an individual, I don't make much of a difference in terms of reducing my GHG emissions. But if you reduce your GHG emissions and talk about it and email your local politicians about how important it is that we all start doing this, then that's what enables a systemic change to happen as well.
Your team must be thinking about this, Ian, and our website really does emphasize some of the individuals in our community that have taken action and played a role. So where's the balance for you between those big policy moves that we're working on versus encouraging people to exercise their own efforts?
Yeah, I guess to me they're kind of two sides of the same coin. And I think the people, us in this conversation, are in this kind of fortunate position when we get to play a role in both of those. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't, you know, besides being active citizens, don't have as much say in policy and bylaws, et cetera. So, you know, so allowing people to do what they can with the tools that they have is really important. I definitely think both, you know, they're inextricably linked, that one drives the other and one pushes the other toward action. And we really need to tackle them both.
It's really true. And I appreciate this idea of people's individual action creating political will. And I think people often underestimate how much courage it will take elected officials to make the big policy changes that they need to make to address the climate emergency. And so the more people writing to their politicians, encouraging them to take bold action locally, provincially, federally, is actually really important. We have polls that show the majority of citizens understand that climate change is real, that it needs to be addressed, that it is a major priority for Canadians. And yet still, some of that political courage is lacking. And so I don't want people to underestimate the very, very important role they have in encouraging that kind of courage in their political leaders and electing people that will act in the coming elections. So that is really important. I think sometimes people think, does a letter really matter? And I read all the emails that we get on matters locally, and they do matter. They absolutely influence our thinking. And we may not always side with an individual letter, but it no doubt has changed our perspective on how we're thinking about an issue or the decision that we're making or why we're making a decision. So I do encourage people never to forget that is actually a really big power that each individual holds. So here's the thing, Ian, we have these six big moves. It's a massive plan. We've already admitted that it actually doesn't get us all the way there. We're going to have to keep seeking out opportunities. So how are you prioritizing with council? Like, what do we do first and what needs to wait? Because we can't do the whole plan at once. And yet we've got 9 years. So how has that been prioritized within your team and what we're actioning first out of our community climate action plan?
Sure. That's a great question. And just if that wasn't enough, also, it doesn't even include all of the emissions. Embodied emissions aren't in there. So just add that little spice to the cocktail. So for us, we're really trying to be relentlessly pragmatic and also very opportunistic in our approach. We're in a pretty interesting point in time when the other levels of government are trying to add stimulus to the economy in various ways. So really being up on that and really trying to take advantage of these other opportunities that we can leverage to kind of punch above our numbers. That's something we're really working toward. One thing that has been very valuable is we've trying to collaborate more and more with other local governments. And there's this tremendous spirit of sharing and teamwork with this amongst this topic. So, you know, Whistler is a great example. We are talking with Whistler. I talk with my counterpart in Whistler several times a week, and we're collaborating on many projects. Very often the provincial and federal government look very favorably when you're part of a collaboration in a project. So, you know, if we can work together and do the same things and learn from each other, and sometimes, I'll be honest, just copy from each other, that's a way that we can really, really move ahead. So that's a few of the things.
Jenna, what's your sense as you look at what we've prioritized in our budgets and around the Community Climate Action Plan?
I like the words that Ian used, pragmatic and opportunistic, and balancing those two. I think in terms of the actions that we've prioritized in this year's budget, at least, really balances those two. So the things that we know are quick, big wins in terms of reduction emissions, like the landfill gas capture and flaring. And then also identifying where there is opportunity for higher level or grants from higher levels of government. And I'd say we also take that approach when we think about our role for advocacy to both the provincial and federal government as well. Looking at that as both a where is there opportunity? We know that there's work going on, and so let's help push them in that direction. And then also, where are we seeing the really big blocks where we need their help so that we have more leverage to move some of these things forward, and where do we push that? So that more pragmatic sense, I think, are two good pieces that we pull both from implementing actions as well as advocacy.
Yeah, to me, the overwhelming sense of the need for deep collaboration, not reinventing the wheel, as you say, Ian. Like, if someone's already figured something out, we're just going to copy it. Like, we don't need to be the creator of all good ideas. And so I think that that spirit amongst local governments of, yeah, we want to go fast. And who's ahead on this? Like, who can we follow on this particular policy piece? Because there will be areas where we're leading. And I think our low carbon incentive that went to public hearing is one of those places. I think our smart growth density discussion that we have going on in our neighborhood planning are leading in a lot of respects. So we're happy to share there, but what can we learn from the progress other communities are making? And Jen and I now sit together on the regional district board, and we've approved a full-time climate person for the region, which I think that now gives yourself and Whistler sustainability manager and climate change someone to work with on that regional level, like all the way up past Lillooet to down to Burry Creek. So that's amazing to me that we can start to take a regional lens to addressing this. And I don't want to miss also sort of some of the things we're doing at the district behind the scenes that don't necessarily capture headlines. So our strategic procurement policy that we changed. So now awarding contracts based on GHG emissions, whether people are paying a living wage, whether they can help support reconciliation, all those things can start to be considered into how we contract the work we need to do at the district, which is exciting. And we're part of the Coastal Communities Social Procurement Initiative. And that's a big collaboration with a whole bunch of local governments on the island, Sunshine Coast. So I'm super excited to be part of that. And then also we have a whole internal team that's looking at our buildings and how we can reduce our footprint as a district. So right now we have to buy offsets to be carbon neutral, but one of our goals is to reduce the amount we need to offset by just having more efficient buildings and doing things differently. So, you know, I love that work is going on, and maybe doesn't make the headlines, but is absolutely critical. And one of
that work, sorry.
Head in, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to add that work is a real stitch in time, because it's so much easier to build an efficient building than to retrofit an existing building. So we have this like once in a 10 generation opportunity with the number of new corporate buildings that we can build them well now and save ourselves a lot of emissions and a lot of money over the long term. So it's a really exciting point in time for that. Cal Bragg and Corinne Ledoux are both working really hard on that and others.
Maybe you could say a bit about the fire hall and our ability to sort of set an example as well for the building community.
Sure. I guess one cool example that comes to mind is the deconstruction of the fire hall. So we were able to quite kind of late in the game ask for a pretty aggressive diversion of the materials from the fire hall demolition. And I believe we ended up with over 90% diversion from the fire hall. So 9 out of 10 kilograms of material did not end up in our landfill. So it's an interesting opportunity for us to show that this is not, you know, doing this is not economic
Armageddon.
Suicide. Yeah, that it can happen, and it can happen relatively easily, and that this is something that should happen to every deconstruction that's going on.
And it's super important, because closing the loop on waste is one of the 6 big moves. And you might remember the number off the top of your head, Ian, in terms of what percentage of our GHG emissions come from waste specifically.
About 20.
Yeah. So that's a big piece that we can make some substantial moves on with examples like that.
Totally.
All right. So there's a really interesting conversation coming up with our economic leadership team this week around the donut economy and Kate Raworth's work on that. And so one of the questions that came up in the mayor's drop-in was like growth for growth's sake. And, you know, is it time to start changing our thinking on that? And I am fascinated by this idea of what does success look like for our community in addressing climate and also making sure that the city is livable? So I don't know if you guys have had much exposure to the work of the on the donut economy, but I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on what you heard in the conversation today around how fast we should be growing or what we should be focused on in terms of our success as a community.
The donut economy is really interesting. I haven't delved into it in a whole bunch of detail, but I think the shift away from measuring success or measuring simply just off GDP is so important, because we know that there are ecological limits, that if we continue just to use those basic measures of growth, they aren't going to give us the indicators that we need in order to actually measure, are we happy? Are we healthy? What does our community really want to look and feel like in 15 years, rather than just, hey, our GDP has grown by X percent. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited to hear that this conversation is going to be happening amongst our community and with our business community to get their sense of how do we start to shift? What other indicators do we need to start to think about? And I think in our conversation in the mayor's drop-in, it came up from an economic development perspective. And we often talk about growth of target sector firms and bringing more jobs here to Squamish. It is part of our strategic plan to increase the number of target sector employers year over year. But there is a piece there in our framing of the strategic plan that I do think is missing, which is it isn't growth just for growth's sake. It's growth so that in 5 years' time, we have fewer people that are commuting on the highway and they can actually work here and live here and play here, and that they can actually get what it is they need down the street and they have that livable, walkable community. And so I think that conversation around the donut economy will help us start to think about going beyond the indicators that we've typically used and what else do we need to be measuring in order to measure the success of our community in the long term.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so important to start aligning more with the UN sustainability goals. And I think the donut economy concept gets us closer to that, but there's multiple factors, as you say, that lead to the success of a community than just economic growth.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I love the quote from Elizabeth May that said, you know, there's nothing that a dead planet can offer to the economy, but lots of free parking. And it just really, really speaks to the idea that, like, us just thinking about the economy as an end to itself is so limited. That so thinking about the economy more broadly and the benefits are to people is a much better way to go about this. And I feel like our economic development team really embraces that.
Yeah, that's a great point. All right, just to wrap up. I would love to know if you've read a book or listened to a podcast around climate change or something that you're reading now or listening to now that you would recommend to folks that are listening to this podcast. Jenna.
Oh, I have a great podcast suggestion. It's a Gimlet podcast called How to Save a Planet. It is fantastic. It dives into all kinds of different topics on very solutions oriented. How is it that we are going to save our planet from climate change? And here are the actions that we need to take. So that is a fantastic one. On my nightstand, I do have Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything that I am trying to power through. I'm about 2/3 of the way and I'm not sure I'm going to make it. But it is also a very good and eye-opening book. It is just very, very dense.
Right. Thank you. In website, podcast, book, what would you recommend?
Sure. This is about a 60-year late recommendation, but I actually just finally finished the book Dune, which I just loved in the pandemic. Reading science fiction is just this great way to escape, which we can't in many other ways right now. And it's just such an interesting ecological understory to it, the way they're trying to to make this planet habitable. So I just really, really enjoyed that and got a lot out of it. So
great recommendation. I am on a panel in May with Seth Klein, and so thought I should actually read his new book. So I am reading A Good War, Mobilizing Canada for the Climate Emergency. And I've just started it and really intrigued by this idea of, you know, if we can mobilize our economy and our people to support the cause around the Second World War, how would we do it for climate change? And what's my role in that? So very interested both to read the book and also to hear what Seth has to say at the conference in May. So.
And last but not least, we can't forget a shameless plug for squamish.ca/climate action.
Yes.
It has all of the details about our community climate action plan, local steps that you can take, and some deep dives on how climate adaptation and mitigation is being addressed by the district.
Thanks, Jenna. That's a good plug. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in today. If you've got any feedback on this podcast or any of the others, send an email or send a note to communications@squamish.ca. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time on District B-Sides.